Well, thank you. Thank you for that kind introduction. It's nice to, it's very nice to be here. I've been thinking for the last days while I, in preparation for coming up here, that it was 40 years ago in May, so coming up on 41 years ago, that that I graduated from Calvin and went off to into the world of medieval studies. And so I can't help but think about some of my teachers and friends, and David Diephaus, who was in my class at Calvin, went to the East Coast when I went to the West Coast for graduate study. I also couldn't help but think that, though I've been here often and on many occasions, as some of you know, I don't remember if or when I was actually invited to give a stand-up lecture. It just happened that yesterday I was in the gym late in the day, and Al Planning's locker is more or less right next to mine. I just happened to mention this to him, and he said, well, John, I think they were waiting to see how you would turn out. So I hope I'll find some approval. This is a very broad lecture. I thought that might be helpful rather than boring deep into something medieval where many of you might lose your way. I apologize if it's superficial or if it goes too fast, and I welcome all questions. In the mid-20th century, several distinguished historians located the Western world's technological progress in a Christian worldview, particularly in monasticism, and more specifically, Benedictine monasticism. I refer, of course, to Louis Mumford, Ernst Benz, and one of my own teachers, Lynn White, Jr. Contrarywise, Jacques Le Goff found that labor in the Middle Ages meant, first of all, travail, hardship, the consequence of sin, and thus also penance. Though he conceded that its valuation shifted over time with culture and came to mirror the more dynamic society that emerged in the 12th century. George Ovid, these are some authors that recently dealt with these sorts of things, subsequently examined all of this much more soberly. Patricia Rompf, more enthusiastically, and my colleague Sabine McCormick now in an article entitled The Virtue of Work and Augustinian Transformation. In short, some scholars see in historic Christianity attitudes towards labor of immense positive social and cultural consequence, and others are far more dubious, even decidedly negative. If with our mental eyes we scan the visual images that have come down to us from the Middle Ages and bracket out those that principally represent power, the earthly power of princes and prelates, the divine power of God enthroned or sitting in judgment or hanging in agony, then of those that remain, a very large number represent people either at work or in prayer, in fields or in choir, astride a horse or kneeling before an image, busy with a tool or reading a prayer book. Among historians, nonetheless, interest in labor as such has sagged generally with socioeconomic history in the last while, and prayer, despite all the recent attention to monks, saints, and spirituality, seems somehow beyond the historian's grasp or perhaps even too intimate for it. And whatever our fitful attentions to workers and prayers, we have given still less to the points of intersection. A desperate speaker might wonder indeed where in the Middle Ages to turn for evidence. Consider the much invoked three orders scheme. For those of you who don't know it, a scheme that was very widespread in the Middle Ages from the 11th century on, of dividing society into workers, fighters, and prayers. Consider the much invoked three-order scheme widespread in medieval society from the 11th century onwards, with the great majority of people put to work and select minorities set apart to pray and fight. Or take another image. About 1160, John of Salisbury learnedly treated society as a body, the royal head, the priestly heart, the arms of knightly and judicial powers respectively, and so on. The feet, he poignantly says, are peasant workers, those on whom the whole body stands and moves. And yet he devoted barely a paragraph to them. All the rest of his marvelous Polycraticus focused on rulers and bishops and fighters and courtier counselors. Or consider the biblical week as it settled into medieval law and practice, 6 days for work, one for prayer. The reverse for those set apart as professed religious, thus almost exclusively for Sabbath prayer. In the expository language of the influential early 14th century biblical glossator, Nicholas of Lyra, this is the commentary in effect that everyone turned to from the 14th century on for a basic reading of the meaning of a text, straight on, in fact, into Reformation times. This Nicholas of Lyra, a Parisian master and Franciscan friar, the 6 days, he says, are for sustaining the things required for human life, the necessaria. The seventh, for full focus on divine worship. Divini cultui totaliter applicas. You apply yourself then fully to divine worship. Or as he also puts it, the time when you are obliged to be free for things divine. Obliged to be free for things divine. That refers, of course, to the fact that if the crops were coming in and a hailstorm was on the way, you weren't allowed to go into the fields on the Sabbath. But of course, you know that coming out of a Sabbatarian culture. whence my title? How did all this play out? Was prayerful worship dutiful labor or restful recreating? Was sustaining life through work travail or fruitfully fulfilling? Can we even answer such questions? I begin with Scripture. Certain texts, more than I can mention here, continuously framed this conversation during the Middle Ages, however variously invoked to justify diverging practices. God placed Adam and Eve in the Garden of Paradise to tend and care for it, work as delight. But after they ate the forbidden apple and were removed, they had to work merely to survive and to work land cursed with thorns and thistles. Eve condemned to bear children in labor, travail, a play on words still current in many European languages. Adam to harvest and eat only by way of laborious work and the sweat of his brow. The 12th century ordinary gloss, the ordinary gloss was the work of this sort, referential sort that one would have turned to in the 1100s, from the 1100s on, to get the basic meaning of a text. Transmitting Augustine here says in double negatives, listen, in double negatives, that these are the labors of humankind on earth no one does not know, and that this would not be so if the bliss that was paradise had been kept. The Franciscan exegete, Nicholas of Lyra, whom we just mentioned, two centuries later, offered a strikingly, if not nastily, domestic version. For taking the apple, woman was subjected to man in punishment, and man thus also punished because he had now to procure necessities for her and the entire household. Working the land in turn produced anxiety in him, whereas prior to the fall, tending the land was pleasurable for him. Note the amazing contrapposto here with a nasty gendered turn. Intriguingly, at the outset of the New Testament, the devil tempted Jesus straightway to make it easy for himself by turning stones into bread, to which Christ retorted from Deuteronomy, "Man does not live by bread alone, but by the word of God." Friar Nicholas glossed this to mean, a person can live in spirit and in body on the word of God alone, citing Moses fasting 40 days and nights in the desert, and thinking, it seems, of those zealots in his day who exercised extreme fasting amidst prayer and meditation. Still another fateful juxtaposition of texts appears in the letters of Paul. To the community at Thessaloniki, he issued the following dictum: if a person will not work, he shall not eat. And claimed to have modeled this in his own life while among them, no free sustenance for anyone in the community who was not being productive. Yet to that same community, he had also said in an earlier letter, pray without ceasing. How to work productively and pray without ceasing all at once, that became the dilemma for those who took both texts to heart. Or again, a widely invoked image in the Middle Ages, Martha and Mary, one busy with domestic tasks, the other sitting in rapt attention at the feet of the teacher, the latter designated as the pars optima, the best. So could one pray and work, meditate and be productive? Or were these, in historical actuality, particularly in medieval social life, utterly distinct acts, even separate social roles? In every historic society, people have both worked and prayed. How this is sorted in practice depended on the nature of the religion, the social status assigned to each activity, the gender roles allowed to each, and so on. Christians in the Roman Empire established a modified Hebrew week of work and worship, with some acts, the shedding of blood, for instance, and sexual activity as well, accounted always alien to prayer. Only after they emerged as the majority, however, did they generate a truly distinctive body of teachings and practices. From the 4th century, men and women began to turn their backs on the emerging Roman Christian Empire and enter into solitude, be it a distant desert or a nearby alien place. They went to pray, but they also worked. Wherever we look, from the lives of Anthony or Paul to collective histories of monastic communities to all the early rules, we find the same, prayer and work. This was remarkable on at least two counts. Roman society had always known various sectarian cults and had always had some dedicated priests and priestesses, but religion served in the main and first of all to integrate rather than to separate off. Moreover, the goods of Roman society had mostly still always come first: honor and exercise of the will, property and material needs, family and sex. Christian monks in the Roman Empire inverted Roman values, conceiving a new vision of human ends. This sprang, to stretch here only a little, from placing prayer first. What followed directly was the need for a disciplined spirit and body and hand labor that was self-sustaining. This is how John Cassian introduced Eastern teachings to Western monks in the 420s, a passage formative in medieval religious circles for 1,000 years and more, and I quote, "The end of every monk and perfection of heart aims for a constant and uninterrupted perseverance in prayer, and strives after, insofar as that is granted human fragility, an unmoving and perpetual tranquility of mind. For this we unwearyingly seek in every work of the body, as in contrition of spirit. For this we constantly exercise." End quote. The end is tranquillitas, sometimes also quies, quietude. The way is unceasing prayer. The human means are labor and contritio. So joined were all these, Cassian says elsewhere, that true monks acquire genuinely outstanding progress in spirit and illumination in knowledge owing to constancy in work. And in turn, they exercise manual labor ceaselessly owing to their spiritual meditation, the one entirely bound up with the other. All this largely cut against fundamental Roman attitudes and behaviors, though some, to be clear, some schools of Hellenistic thought, especially Stoic, had aimed to cultivate the mind or virtue amidst a life of otium. Still, to make prayer the unmoving center of it all, and to expect work of everyone, regardless of social rank or education, hand labor no less, that is to say slave labor, this made no sense. This transformation, we must understand, played itself out amidst long-standing Roman assumptions about otium and negotium, that is, leisure and work or business. Choosing to make baskets or cook or harvest crops, to work with the hands for one's own sustenance, to take up slave labor voluntarily as penitential exercise, this undercut all the dignity normally accorded to Roman otium. Here was a new kind of otium, potentially extending to people way down the social ranks, but it came mixed with degrading negotium, leisure wherein one was to be busy, with prayer and reading certainly, but also with self-supporting hand labor. Was the effect of all this then, as some historians have claimed, to revalue work? Even in this brief and all too simplistic description, we see at once the complications, theological and social. Labor, even labor corporis, labor of the body, meaning in the first instance effort, indeed a paradoxical effort, to pray to become tranquil, to work to become quiet, though such labor corporis certainly also included labor manuum, the work of the hands, manual labor for self-support or to ward off idleness. Jerome said simply that all Egyptian monasteries required it, both for sustenance and for salvation. To understand this properly, we need to further round out this picture. These early solitaries, male or female, were not people living off church endowments or ministry to the church. They were nearly all, women and men, lay people. This is evident in Augustine's rule, initially written for women, in fact, but in Benedict's II, a full century later. Further, they were themselves self-consciously trying to, or at least enjoined to, set aside inherited social or economic distinctions. This, in fact, the very first point made in Augustine's rule, quite firmly, in fact, but also evident still in a Benedict's. Effort of mind and body, labor in the general sense, was required of all, directed to penance and prayer. Labor of the hands was also expected of all, whether or not they entered with means, whether or not the house had patrons or endowments. About prayer itself, seems like I keep trying to get you set up to follow all this, about prayer itself, we need additionally to understand, and this would hold throughout the Middle Ages, that it referred in the first instance to a concrete act, reciting the Psalms, saying or singing the Hours. Christian prayer quickly acquired varied meanings and forms and expressions, to be sure, multiplying through the Middle Ages, but it always generally pointed to, or presumed, the performance of set texts, the Pater Noster, the Our Father, for most lay people, the Psalms and prayers for the Psalms and Hours for the clergy, and books of hours later for some laity. In the 14th century, Nicholas of Lyra, again our friar, glossing that notion of praying without ceasing, said simply, at the appointed times and hours. Cassian presumed it too, despite his soaring vision. Keeping a constant round of recited psalms and prayers was thus the monk's chief task, his opus, his work. This, the fact, the second point in Augustine's rule, and this comprised, in fact, the largest part of Benedict's text. Okay, now that by way of setting all that up. Now, the historical complications start to roll in. One way for historians to catch the drift of a society is to observe where it emerges as excess. Already in the 5th century, to judge from protests and complaints, there were any number, taking up prayerful solitude as full-time leisure. Augustine, at his bishop's request, assailed some in Carthage who wanted to be free, the word is vacare, as in our word vacation, only for prayer and psalms and the word of God. In his finest rhetorical peak, Augustine pointed out in his De Opera Monachorum that those working with their hands could also quite easily sing spiritual songs and so bring solace to the labor itself with spiritual rhythms. Do we not know, he goes on, what vanities and obscenities craftsmen in the theater indulge even as they work with their hands? These words from Augustine would get invoked repeatedly at key junctures over the next centuries. Benedict II was clear about the danger of this new dedicated prayer life becoming simply leisure, idleness. Otiositas, we still have the word otios. Otiositas, this in fact, significantly, a new Christian word, that wasn't a Roman word, a new Christian word loaded down with all the negative, that is in that form of it, with all the negative dimensions of Roman otium, signifying now potentially and quite ironically a vice chiefly associated with monks. To avoid it, he famously taught, this is chapter 48 of Benedict's rule, they should spend set times in manual labor and set times in reading. Okay, so to avoid otiositas, you need manual labor and reading. Prayer, opus dei, defined the day. That was the work. Labor and reading helped to fill it and discipline it. By the mid-6th century, this labor was mostly domestic in the kitchen or cellar or gardens. If monks had also to do rougher field work to bring in the harvest, Benedict famously noted, they should not grieve, because they were truly monks if they lived by the work of their hands as the fathers had. That ideal thus already fading, apparently, as monastic houses became endowed and privileged institutions, but present still as a kind of golden dream or ideal. What then about the great majority of Christians outside dedicated houses of prayer? Was theirs a life only of negotium, of work, of business? If we look to Caesarius preaching at Arles in the generation before Benedict penned his rule, we find countless exhortations to laboring at the virtues, but nearly nothing about work itself. It entirely presumed just reminders, interestingly, to pay your tithes on your produce. As for prayer, beyond repeated injunctions to learn the Lord's Prayer and to teach it to their children and godchildren, it comes closely associated with attending church on Sunday. This is what they were to do there: pray for their sins, pray in praise, sing psalms, not carry on with others in otios, that word again, and worldly tale-telling. Caesarius here alerts us to another aspect of prayer in medieval experience, beyond its rootedness in set texts. It's being anchored in sacred spaces, in churches or at shrines. Work is what went on in the world, prayer in church. Four centuries later, in a very early mirror for Christians of all differing ranks, someone named Rother of Verona in the 930s began with what he described as the common Christian, the majority plebs, the peasant. Be a laborer, he says, esto laborator. Not only just but assiduous, content with your own, defrauding no one, fear God, invoke saints, attend church, honor priests, offer the tithes of your labors to God, and so on. These were lives defined by work. Physical work producing sustenance for themselves and others, moral work in respecting others, for he also invokes them to love your wife and her alone, visit the sick, and so on. The only form of prayer, noted specifically, was calling upon the saints. Something one could do outside church, though it would tend to be associated probably with shrines. Two centuries later, the Benedictine Honorius Augustodunensis, he's a kind of encyclopedist from the 12th century, and his stuff spread everywhere. In a brief review of social types, said notably and famously that peasant people would mostly be saved in the end because they lived simply and fed the people of God by their sweat. By contrast, few knights would, owing to their plundering, and few merchants or artisans owing to their fraud. Scholars have often noted his empathy for the peasants and their labor. This is a passage that often gets cited in this kind of context, from whose work, it should be noted, Honorius also lived. But we should also note this. He does not expect them to be saved by their prayers. It's by their work. Though our sources are not so plenteous until the 12th century, the moral complexities of all this were not lost on people and could generate nagging, if rarely articulated, worries among monks. Would all their effort, that is the monks' effort, all those prayers and masses and vigils and fasts, in the end, get them no more than lay people suffering their worldly afflictions but producing sustenance? Yield for monks no hundredfold rather than the lay folks 30-fold, which is the common way of interpreting that parable. That is, the monks got 100-fold, lay people got 30-fold, clergy got 60-fold. As Rudolphus Glauber tells it, he's a monastic chronicler of the early 11th century, in the 1030s, a demon planted precisely that thought in some monk, very probably himself, a story indeed we have, in fact, written out still in his own hand. I didn't take a picture of it long, but anyway. This monk had, notably, no real response to this tempting thought, except to say that it was a notion most false, altogether demonic, and it was important to keep in mind that not everybody, in fact, would gain glory. By 500 years after Benedict, 600 after Augustine, large-scale historical changes had taken place. Monks had ceased to be lay, nearly all now clerics, most priests. The Opus Dei, with vast expansions and private masses, was conceived in large part as intercessory work for benefactors, while work of the hands rested entirely upon peasants whose lands and labor supplied monastic houses with income and sustenance. Then, from about 1050, new monks and canons rebelled against this. They insisted upon a straitened sung prayer as well as contemplative meditation, often required manual labor, and made a place for peasant laborers within monastic life as conversi, lay brothers, lay sisters. This famous Reformation of the 12th century, as Giles Constable has labeled it, is often noted and hailed, though not always without nuance with respect to this question of labor. What we must see, it seems to me, in a broader way, is the matters of work and of prayer both put forcefully back on the table across society and culture, yielding no single program such as the Cistercian. This is the one that's usually cited, the Cistercians requiring manual labor, going back to the letter of the rule. Cistercians, for those of you who don't have a good sense of that, it's the right name here, but your mental image of it would probably be Trappists. Trappists are 17th century, it's a 17th century reform of Cistercians, but probably something closer to what 12th century Cistercians would have looked like. Yielding no single program such as the Cistercian, even if it became the most influential and widespread, but instead a host of wildly divergent and inventive responses. And that's what I'm going to take you through now, focusing the paper a bit now, or quite a bit of it here on the 12th century, which is what I happen to be working on at the moment. The traditional Benedictine, meaning the Benedictines of the kind that had grown up across the early Middle Ages, Rupert of Deutz, was writing in the Diocese of Cologne in the mid-1120s, just as Cistercians and Canons Regular first made their presence felt, that is, the new monks with these new claims about what you needed to do. In fact, with his archbishop just across the River Rhine patronizing the new orders. Rupert noted two things. First, some were actually saying that a soul could not be saved unless you worked with your hands. Second, since Benedict had barely mentioned the priesthood, some monks were now forgetting that they were priests. Hence the burning question, almost unimaginable jolt for someone like Rupert. Was it better, and I'm quoting him here basically, was it better, indeed more apostolic, to live by the work of the hands or from the altar and its income? Rupert could be sharp and was here cast on the defensive. What Benedict said about acquiring one's victuals, about plowing and planting and so on, he smoothly opined, was uttered as permission, not as precept. A concession in necessity, not what he wanted for monks. As proof, silently passing over the Desert Fathers that I spent the first third of the paper on here, Rupert cited Gregory and others who had endowed monks so that they would not need to work in fields, so the otium of holy contemplation would not be disturbed, and he uses that word. It is good to work with the hands to flee otiositas, he conceded, but best to flee it by spending Sabbath rest in holy otium with the word. Rupert himself proved to be, in fact was already, the most prolific biblical commentator of his time and understood his own calling as one, to interpretation, as one that was spirit-informed. Nowhere, he says here, does one come closer to the word than at the altar. This applies equally to illiterate lay monks who help serve at the altar. Then he goes on provocatively. Benedict's rule, echoing its text, was for beginners. Its monastic yoke, only a beginning. Those who added to it a clerical life of priesthood, these attained apostolic perfection. Why would people invest nearly their entire hope in the work of their hands when they could be committing themselves to that highest service, commemorating Christ at the altar, and coincidentally receive goods for their labor? Opus Dei is here itself rendered emphatically as labor, and monk priests as the worthiest laborers. There's the totum quotidianum spiritualis operis exercitium, the full daily exercise of spiritual work. Moreover, the harvest is great, he says, and the workers few, meaning that many have given gifts and asked for prayers, but few priests now rise above scandalous merchant priests to act as monk priests. Objecting to their work at the altar was beyond comprehension. Rupert's text though underutilized by historians, is key because it came earliest, that is, chronologically earliest, and forced from him an articulation of the black monk's implicit vision of contemplative prayer and priestly intercession as, in fact, itself work and the worthiest work. So did new monks and canons really rest their salvation on the work of their hands, on getting out in the field instead of being in the choir singing psalms? Extant studies, in my view, have tended to romanticize this turn to manual labor. In the margins of early Cistercian manuscripts, to be sure, we have wonderful images of laboring monks and some striking verbal images as well. Bernard of Clairvaux's celebration, in fact, in his sermons on the Song of Songs, number 26, of his just departed brother, it's a grieving lament, the loss of his brother, who as cellarer in the convent, in the monastery, had handled all manner of internal practical affairs as well as socioeconomic business, while Bernard could only bewail his own uselessness. A closer look, however, turns up far less than we might have imagined. What we find instead is a steady insistence upon following the rule and the paradigm of the Desert Fathers, all to prevent monks from turning idle time into disaster, thus otiositas again. Canons regular, for their part, that's another part of this new movement, ones that lived in a slightly different arrangement of life, Victorines in particular, this is an important group in Paris, cited that passage from Augustine that I quoted before, and imagined prayer as combined with clerical tasks somewhat closer to the world. If these new monks and canons testify to an important shift, it was, I would argue, of another kind, that is, to internal work, to the lexio side of Benedict's equation. Remember, Benedict said, to avoid otiositas, idleness, leisure, you need some manual labor and you need some lexio, some reading. With benefactions and private masses now in principle cut out, the Opus Dei reduced to Benedict's original program rather than filling the whole day, or Augustine's spare outline, monks and canons were left with far more time in their day and, so to speak, on their hands. That time and labor now went, I would suggest, to internal work. Too often, the unprecedented explosion of writing in this era, which those of us who work in this era know all about, a spiritual literature that literally shifted the foundations of Western spiritual teaching, Bernard and Anselm and all the rest, gets treated as a given, as the pendant or the expression or something of the new monks and canons' meditative turn. But it had not been there for 500 years. It sprang from this new internal work, the work of meditative prayer and the head and hand work of articulating experience in wondrous Latin prose and prayers and hymns. Here, I'm going to focus on just a couple of examples. First, on an influential canon, Richard of St. Victor, his so-called 12 Patriarchs, or Benjamin Minor, from about the year 1160. This is a complex guide to achieving the heights of contemplative prayer by way of meditative exegesis, a meditation on the 12 Patriarchs. Richard proceeded by unpacking the meaning of biblical names and persons, the 12 patriarchs born of Jacob and his four partners, Leah and Rachel, Bilhah and Zilpah, an exegetical task worked out in a Latin prose that was at once intricate and appealing. All begins with Leah, the unwanted first wife, whose name he understood from Jerome to mean, interesting, laboriosa, laborious. And all concludes with Rachel, whose name means, among other things, videns Deum, seeing God. Leah signifies the great labor by which the affections of the soul or spirit are bent back from the libidinous to the licit. By contrast, nothing is sweeter, more pleasant, than to raise the eye of the mind to the contemplation of the highest wisdom, that is, to Rachel. The steps are complex, as the sons are many. The meanings of their names disclosed as little bursts of revelation, hard-won internal experience rendered now into Latin prose. Her son Gad, for instance, which Jerome took from the Hebrew to mean as pointing towards temptation, reveals that abstinence is labor, yet a labor felicitous rather than calamitous. Labor or effort in itself is not true delight, but can be false. And at one point it's assimilated to Shechem, the figure who raped Dinah, the brother's sister. By contrast, Leah and her sons represent a labor, laboriosa, that goes into the remaking of a person inwardly and outwardly, composing the human, componera, literally composing the human, not one working only to attain human vanities or pleasures, that is, remaking it. The human itself can be composed, remade, reordered, a work at once spiritual and laborious. To ascend the heights of prayerful contemplation requires labor, as distinguished from simply existing in such a high otium. Once there, moreover, while dwelling in it, you are able to be busy or constant, assiduous, without any laborious effort. A wondrous sweetness sustained, he says, with no effort, sine labore. Greatest of all, though, and finally, is to be at rest there. Now, this is just a tiny thing of a book that goes on and on, working out the most intimate details of at once the exegesis of these names and, in effect, a kind of retelling of the whole nature of a spiritual journey, which has the effect of recomposing the human through a combination of labor and contemplation. Here, labor and contemplative prayer have become interwoven in a complex conception of reworking the whole human interior. The term for this activity, partly inherited but pervasive from the 12th century onwards, also then in later medieval vernaculars, was exercitium, exercise. The exercise or project of training and remaking the self, at once laborious duty and wondrous delight. This form of prayer and work, unlike the black monk's intercessory labors at the altar, was additionally, potentially, gender neutral. It is no accident, in my view, that Richard's work, like much else in this new spirituality, was widely read subsequently by women as well as by men, especially in later medieval translation. They too, if denied the work of priestly intercession, could undertake internal work, could remake the human. Remake themselves. This remaking and rethinking of intersections between prayer and work went beyond a defense of intercessory labors at Mass, as Rupert, or a new insistence on choir monks doing hand labor, as Cistercians held, or this taking up of the internal work of meditation and writing. We find as well in this era, and I'm going to list a whole series of things, the inclusion of peasant workers, male or female, as conversi. Though they were often treated, in fact, it seems, as second-class citizens among the Latinate choir monks, we find stipulated just in their horarium, or daily schedule of prayer, this injunction, beyond appointed times in church, to make their prayers wherever they happen to be working. It probably exists earlier, but I haven't seen it, at least in 12th century texts earlier. The newly formed Templar and other knightly orders famously combined prayer and fighting into a single blessed vocation, an innovation unimaginable earlier when shedding blood still required penance and an absolute horror to the Eastern Church. At more ordinary levels, the sacralization of knighthood moved into full flourishing in these same years, thus receiving the sword belt after vigil prayer and penance, blessing the sword, a solemn charging and blessing of the knight, and so on. All this, whatever else was going on here, including, we have to say, a sacred sanctioning of class and violence, marked as well another conjoining of work with prayer, ideally of discipline with intercession and submission. On still another front, the Victorines at Paris in particular integrated the mechanical arts into the mechanical arts, that is the craftsman's art, into the sphere of legitimate knowledge, a move much discussed in historical literature, even if its significance or influence is still debated. And about the same time, the pseudonymous person, also a Benedictine monk called Theophilus Presbyter, defended the craftsman's art as part of human image likeness to God and is infused with the sevenfold spirit when applied to the ornamentation of worship. Thus, craftsmanship lifted implicitly to the status of worship. Still, all this did not alter the now 7 or 8 century old expectation that the perfect life was ultimately and supremely about prayer, not about work. It stretched and adapted that notion, and in various ways it elevated labor here, or brought labor even more decidedly into the picture. But the ideal life was still to be about prayer, and we can test that in a somewhat unusual way. By way of Joachim of Fiore, who died in 1202, the last of the 12th century Cistercian writers and the great prophet of later medieval apocalyptics. Some of you may not know him, but he's really the great apocalyptic thinker of the High Middle Ages and Late Middle Ages. Founder of his own religious order in southern Italy, a more austere offshoot of the Cistercians, he himself labored at reading scripture and at reading his own times. He uncovered a complex set of exegetical concords, as he called them, an Old Testament age of the Father and of married laity, a New Testament age of the Son and of secular, meaning diocesan churchmen, and a dawning age of the Spirit and of contemplative religious, which had been adumbrated in Benedict, was moved now into being by Bernard, and was awaiting full fruition, as he reckoned it, in about 2 generations. That would be about 1260. This exegetical and prophetic work, to be clear, he casts as labor, indeed as the most difficult of labor, that is to be able to see this, to be able to find this, to work this out in Scripture and to work this out in your own time, he casts as the hardest imaginable work. It is the stuff of boys, he says, to grasp the letter and instruct the exterior person or the married folks, the stuff of adults to acquire spiritual understanding and form the interior person, that is, clerics. While in the third, he says, the contemplative, spirit-filled third age or third status, labor, interestingly, ceases, and the purified vessel is filled with fruit and wine and sings alleluia, for in Sabbath rest there is no labor. That time, however, is not yet, Joachim is plain to say, though it might be within glimpsing. For our purposes, his studies of the 10-chord Psalter and of the Rule, which are both lie at the heart of the Benedictine Opus Dei, are the most revealing. Consider the Sabbath. Literally, he says it means periodically to be free for the Psalms and divine meditation. Morally, it refers to those who turn from the world to full divine service, but the word is really that of servitude, servitium. Tropologically, it means to stop observing the law according to the letter and to serve in the spirit, in liberty, that is, to move from duty to delight. Contemplatively, which is the highest in this life, a taste of the third age, it is to pass over, and this is what he describes this third age as, to pass over from a perfected life in labor to a life of leisure, ad vitam otiosam. Leisure, otiositas, remember, being that which Benedict wanted monks to overcome with reading and manual labor. Here, vita otiosa, becoming the ultimate form of life in the apocalyptic third age. Movement from the second to the third status, he says repeatedly, adumbrated by Benedict, set in motion by Bernard, was a move from the labor to tranquility or quietude, to a time of vacare, when prayer swallows up labor. Until now, he says, the monastic order has borne with labors so it can supplant the sons of the flesh by way of exercises, both corporal and spiritual. Increasingly, it will advance only on the spiritual front, or what I call internal work. And when those labors cease, the new Jerusalem will dawn. For Joachim, this progression corresponds to ages in the Christian life, distinguished not by any count of years, but by distinctions in life forms. Now, interestingly, this monk turned to coinage as an apt metaphor for spiritual value. I haven't seen this before either. Among the three orders of the elect, and that's a scheme going back to Augustine and Gregory, that is, the laity, the clergy, and the contemplatives, the married are likened to a coin valued at 10 denarius, a denarius. The clergy to a coin valued at 20, a vicenarius, and the monks to a coin valued at 30, a tricenarius. He sees the value as cumulative. All begin as laity in labor. to which the clergy add their psalter and the monks their contemplative life. But as with the Trinity, because he conceives all of this as always Trinitarian, each must in some sense co-inhere in the other. Laity approaching God must have a denarius, or if I convert this, a dollar's worth of divine praise or basic prayer, $2 worth of learning or doctrina, and $3 worth of manual labor. That is obviously, they're mostly manual labor, but they're supposed to have a denarius. They're supposed to have a dollar's worth of contemplative life. He, interestingly here, if you follow this, expecting from lay people more knowledge, doctrina, than prayer. A monk must have a denarius in work, a vicenarius in doctrina, and a tricenarius in psalmody, which was also the subject of the book that this has come from, while a cleric has as well a denarius in work, that is the least value, a vicenarius in psalmody, and a tricenarius, the threefold value, in doctrina, in teaching, learning, and so on. Thus, less prayer than teaching. Joachim explains these balances in a variety of ways, and here I just note what he says about the laity. Humbler lives, bound by chains of necessity to wives and labor, cannot abandon that, he says, lest worse befall them, but they thus walk a slower pace in the Christian life. This remarkable set of passages, overlooked so far as I can see, set the intricate relations of prayer and work for different social groups as this prophetic Benedictine imagined them in the 1180s. For labor to be swallowed up finally in perfect Sabbath quietude and freedom of spirit was the stuff of projection, of a new age of the spirit, which he thought was about to dawn. I know it's warm in here, and the evening's getting on. A couple more pages. There follows then one of the great and delicious ironies of history, at least if you're a historian who likes irony. Those who most fully appropriated and diffused Joachim's teachings, who declared themselves his prophesied viri spirituales, spiritual men, were Franciscan friars, men who deliberately set up prayer in the middle of work in towns. More, to overstate only a little, they proposed to beg for their living rather than to work, and act in the world rather than to retire from it. Mendicants overturned a religious ideal, the one I've been describing, going back 8 centuries. Truly a revolution. Even if in practice, choir monks and canons regular had also sometimes engaged with the laboring world. Overnight, friars now emerged as the dominant form of organized religious life and would remain so for 3 centuries. Their churches planted in the center of town, their teaching and preaching and confessing, setting the religious tone until the time of the Reformation. This necessarily propelled a rethinking of work and prayer as great as any undertaken by 12th century Cistercians and Canon Regular and all the others I've been talking about. That's another paper, but I offer here 2 little observations. University masters and secular clergy fiercely attacked the friars' newfangled mix of work and prayer, not least their begging, their proposal in a spirit of true poverty, they said, to live hand to mouth rather than from lands and endowment. The friars struck back, vigorously defending their ministry, teaching, preaching, and confessing, and so on, as work, and always ranking it above opus servile, that is, servile work, that labor of servitude required for the necessities of life. At the same time, though, in their Summae Confessorum and their ad statu sermons, that is, sermons preached to different ranks of society, they approached the life and work of distinct social classes discerningly and really appreciatively. Second, as religious expected still to keep up a divine office, but in reality, often busy and out and about, friars began to conceive of prayer as more mobile, not bound to choir. And they also provided themselves with mobile little prayer books, models for those books of ours that would eventually spread so widely among upper-class laity in the late Middle Ages. And now one more little jump, and then I'll close. In the later 14th and 15th centuries, these mendicants in turn met resistance. Here, too, issues of work and prayer lay very much at the center. Indeed, Langland's Piers Plowman, if you know that poem, might be construed as among the most profound of all reflections on work and prayer to come out of the later Middle Ages. In the late Middle Ages, a variety of new forms of prayer appeared, many actively fostered by friars. Thus, the rosary and stations of the cross and prayer guilds and side altars and books of hours, all tending to blur the line between workers and prayers. But it still did not erase it. However much prayers and their ministry were conceived as workers, and however much workers were now encouraged to cultivate prayer, it was in fact in between groups, in my view, neither entirely religious nor entirely lay, beguines, tertiaries, hermits and solitaries, oblates and donati, sisters and brothers of the common life, even in a way, I think, the Lollards and Hussites, though they have not been approached from this angle, who tried to find and live out some kind of integrated balance between labor and prayer. Most of them repudiated in principle, if not altogether in practice, the begging they associated with mendicants. So too that living off others' labor, which they associated with the monks' lands or the friars' city bonds. Yes, friars had city bonds. For these semi-religious, these in-between, for the women among them, this meant working in textiles, a form of labor considered compatible with a meditative life and also a way of earning an income. For men, of whom there were generally far fewer, in these movements, the women outnumbered the men 10 or 15 to 1 at least. Self-support took more varied forms. Brothers of the common life famously became professional book copyists and spent 6 hours or more each day sitting at desks in their rooms copying books for hire. This, too, was compatible with prayer and meditation, though we must remember, as we know for ourselves as scholars, transcribing to professional standards and reading for personal purposes are not the same thing. In these groups, work and prayer do overlap. We have wonderful stories written by the sisters themselves in memoirs of departed companions, women sitting at a spinning wheel with a book of hours, or of meditations open beside them, or simply turning their minds upwards while their hands continued to work. Some were explicit that they preferred forms of work, such as spinning, which permitted prayer and meditation, as distinguished from other jobs about the house, which allowed for less of an interior life. Nearly all these groups were located in towns, not the countryside, with its routines of peasant labor and parish prayer. In these late medieval towns, moreover, another energy was also at work, ever-deepening resentment of begging among the able-bodied. This, strikingly, and to come full circle, was a blast, another blast against otiositas, leisure, now coming from the civic or burgher side. For them, it was not good enough anymore to say you chose leisure in order to pray and meditate. As these burghers apparently said, nearly pretty much in these words, there were enough prayers about. If indeed you were able-bodied and took alms, you in effect stole from the genuinely poor or the disabled. Especially in the Upper Rhineland, our records are deepest for Basel, but right across Europe, fierce resentment rose against those who would independently set themselves up for prayer outside the legal protection of an order and without, so to speak, paying their own way. So fierce was the criticism that a Dominican, that is a friar, Johannes Nieder, in a still unpublished treatise, came to their defense. A life dedicated to prayer and poverty outside religious vows was permissible, he argued. As for the burgher reaction, one may wonder, though it has not really been approached from this angle, whether that enormous expansion of devotional life and opportunity in the later Middle Ages, all those shrines and chapels and guilds, all the vernacular prayer books and meditations and sermons, whether this had not made it seem obvious or at least possible to civic leaders that one could indeed find multiple ways to pray as a layperson and need not stop out from productive labor in order to do so. The 15th century, notably, first gave rise to the cult of Joseph the Worker and of the Holy Family, the carpenter husband and contemplative virgin together tending their holy child. Still, it is striking, going back in a certain sense to those Romans who turned their backs on imperial Christian society to cultivate prayer and solitude, even if they did eventually set up monastic cities in the desert, striking that those in the Middle Ages who could best exemplify praying and working were people who lived this in-between existence, not married lay workers, not celibate professed prayers. It is even more striking, however, that in the 16th century, nearly all such in-between experiments got shut down by Protestants and Catholics alike. Protestants because these types looked too much still like an apart religious life, Catholics because reform demanded now that the boundaries and disciplines of professed religious life be strictly reinstated. I end with that conundrum and the point where I began, with prayer and work as ideal forms of life and yet as very concretely instantiated social roles, whence the obstacles people faced, certainly in the Middle Ages, perhaps still, in bringing them together.
Thank you so much. We will have a time for questions, so I'd like to invite anyone who has a question to go ahead and ask it.
All questions are welcome. I know you're not all medievalists. Simplest questions are welcome.
Go ahead.
Yes, sir.
Could you perhaps expand on the relationship with the Cistercians to the lay brethren and their eventual incorporation into a movement that had its start?
Okay, yeah, let me untangle a couple of things there. The Cistercians, it's about the relationship of lay brothers to the Cistercians. The Cistercian monks had as their primary goal to reinstate the rule of Benedict literally, ad literam, and therefore to follow its exact prescriptions for what they did in choir and so on. One of the prescriptions, of course, in that chapter 48 was that they should themselves do manual labor. But they also recognized that two things, and there are two ways to look at this, and there were two ways to look at this in the Middle Ages. On the one hand, they recognized that there could be a place for lay people, conversi, and here I need to back up a little bit and explain. In the Middle Ages, in order to be a monk, you had to know Latin. In order to know Latin, you needed to get a start on it. The notion was that if you did not convert, which was the proper term, to monastic life until past, generally it was said at about age 18 or 20, it was impossible for you to learn Latin. Therefore, you couldn't be a choir monk. Therefore, you couldn't anymore become a part of that. So what could you do? The idea was, if you want to look at this generously, that by allowing them to do minimal prayers, the Pater Noster and so on and so forth, and do maximal manual labor, they could nonetheless be a part of the monastery rather than being excluded, as the old system would have. That's the generous interpretation. The less generous interpretation is that Cistercian monks, with the couple or 3 hours a day given to manual labor, couldn't sustain the operation. You couldn't live from it. You needed labor. And so what you do is you bring laborers in on these terms. And in fact, by the end of the middle, I didn't go into all this. I mean, that would be a whole separate paper. In fact, I have a student writing a dissertation on it now. But by the end of the 12th century, you have real tension between, in some cases, between the lay brothers and the choir monks. And you have actual rebellions of lay brothers against the choir monks. You have statutes from the choir monks saying that they may not learn Latin because they don't want them to sneak into becoming choir monks. That's the negative side. But the issue is to get at what was afoot there. Certainly in the earliest days, in most of our texts, it looks like an opening that no longer existed. If you were a peasant laborer with no Latin, the privileges and joys and heavenly benefits of monastic life were shut to you. And now this was a way in. And that would be the positive reading. But the other side is very much there, that the Cistercians needed their labor if they were going to sustain these gigantic monastic operations. Does that help a bit?
Yeah, sort of. I guess maybe you could bring that into your general thesis in this paper.
Well, what I'm trying to do is to not, I don't know if I have a general thesis. What I'm trying to do is to take the problem of work and prayer, and to say, A, that it's one that at least a fair number of the people we study were actually quite self-conscious about and knew that it was an issue. And on the other hand, that there was, for a variety of reasons, social roles, educational issues, and so on, no simple solution to. And maybe is no simple solution to in present age either, even under different social conditions and different educational conditions. But there was no simple solution to. And so we have to be very careful of broad generalizations like, you know, Western, this came out of the early 20th century, but, you know, the Western world values labor more highly than other parts of the world, and this came out of a kind of Christian tradition or something like that. You have to be very careful about that because the evidence is very conflicted as to how this all worked out.
Other questions? Yes.
It seems like the tensions that these different monastic communities are feeling with the relationship between work and prayer is rooted in rereadings of Benedict and trying to
That's one of the sources.
Yeah. I wonder if you've looked at all into Eastern or Greek Byzantine monasticism, and do you think they would have similar kind of tension?
It exists. I'm not an expert on Eastern monasticism, so I can't answer this with any kind of expertise. The same kinds of problems reemerge, though I think a little less sharply, than they do in the West, for reasons that have to do a bit with the social status of monks, the varied social status, with educational issues. It's a bit different, but the fundamental issue of whether monks are supposed to be at leisure to pray, and if that's so, who's going to produce the work that's going to support them? That problem is very difficult to get around. It also can be very difficult to see in texts. When these monks are just talking, this is the historian me complaining about historians of spirituality. When you just read the spiritual texts, what you don't have a sense of is the degree to which these choir monks are, for the most part, a privileged group who are depending upon all kinds of servants taking care of them. And taking care of their needs, and that's easily lost sight of, and sometimes you can see it, and sometimes you can't see it in the texts that are there. I mean, you had it implicitly in Rupert alluding to the fact that there were illiterate lay people helping him at the altar, and so there were people around doing things, but you know the crowd he's addressing is a Latinate choir monk crowd. So this is difficult for us socially to sort out often. And we get closer to it when we see the lay brothers and so on. We get closer to it in the late Middle Ages where the texts are deeper and richer and we can see the social distinctions much more clearly. I think a difficult thing to interpret in a nuanced way because on the one hand, these social distinctions were very, very real, except in most, there are groups that tried to break them down. One of the things that interested me about the Brothers and Sisters of the Common Life was that they are a group that try to break them down, though they retain them. I mean, they're also present there. And they're aware of who is a priest and who is a layman and all that kind of thing, even though in principle they're living in absolute community of life. On the other hand, it was an opening, and the people who went into it felt as fully a part of the religious life and as fully privileged and blessed by it as the people who were the choir monks and could read all the meditations in Latin and say the psalms and so on and so forth. So it's a very complex thing to get at that mix. But there are times when it goes smoothly, and there are times when it literally leads to scenes of what we'd call just straight out social rebellion in these monasteries.
Any other questions? Christina.
So you talk about the tension between work and prayer, and you talk about the idea that prayer could be work, but I'm wondering if you ever run into anything in the people that you've looked at that suggests that work itself could be prayer. This turns up later, but I'm wondering if you've ever...
I've not. I mean, I looked a bit for that. I mean, I think it's not inconceivable, but you don't actually find it. And that's why I said what I said about the nature of prayer. I mean, prayer is conceived of in terms of certain kinds of texts. And therefore, I mean, what is possible is to conceive of being able to recite those texts or reflect on those texts while working. But the point is those texts, that is saying your psalms or whatever else it might be.
That's kind of uniform throughout everybody?
As far as I can tell. I mean, I mean the people who break with it are the mystics.
Right.
But they're, you know, they're a very small crowd. I mean, later on tonight I'm talking about a mystic. But I study them and so on and so forth. But we have to be, I mean, now this is now the historian in me. You have to be clear. This is a very small number of people who do this. They're the texts we get a kick out of reading now, or some of us do. But that's a very small set of people. What these people are worried about when they think about most people is whether they can say their Pater Noster, and that's what praying means, you know, or saying an invocation to a saint. That's what they're worrying about. At that sort of more fundamental level.
We've got a question here and a question in the back. Let's start in front.
You began talking about the arguments or debates about how this has contributed to technology.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm wondering if you've made any correlation between monasteries that leverage technology and those who rejected it in this scheme.
There's been a little work on that. It is the case that... Benedictine monks, including Cistercians, were not afraid of new technology, and that's an interesting point. They also windmills, watermills of various sorts, and all this kind of thing. They also were not afraid of the clock, the mechanical clock, because they were the timekeepers, which they did earlier by, you know, other means, solar clock and so on, water clock, and they were among those who were very happy to bring in the clock and so on and so forth. So that there is evidence that they are not afraid of technology. I found in working on the Brothers of the Common Life, even though they eventually set up printing presses of their own, that they were afraid of the printing press, but for a slightly different reason, and that is that nobody was sure whether they'd be able to make money off it or not. I mean, it was a business venture. But so they're worried about that side of it. But they're worried about the discipline side of it. You see, the copying 6 hours a day was a key part of their sort of religious discipline. And so turning that over into setting up printing presses and so on and so forth looked like a very different sort of thing. And they're actually quite worried about that part of it. Though they do make the transition. And some houses of Brothers of the Common Life become have printing connected to them. So there isn't. I wouldn't say there's a fear connected with technology. On the other hand, I wouldn't say that you'd have to say they are the key source of invention or anything like that.
All right, Barbara in the back, and then here in the front.
Would you have to write two studies, you know, the problem of work and prayer among women in nunneries, you know, in convents, and among men? Because women couldn't go around begging.
So
it seems to be somewhat different.
It is different when you look at the question of begging and when you look at the question of... the work of men being preaching, confessing, that kind of thing, teaching at university. It's not different on the question of choir sisters versus lay sisters. There you have exactly the same thing. That is, choir sisters who were, in principle, if they were choir sisters, expected to say their prayers in Latin, and lay sisters who would say their prayers in the vernacular and would tend to more of the domestic affairs of the monastery. One of the sort of odd imbalances of the Middle Ages is that of established religious houses, now not the semi-religious I was talking about, Beguines and all the rest, of established religious houses, there are far fewer women's houses in the Middle Ages than men's houses. There are far more men's houses. And the reason for that is that you needed to get up these endowments for the women's houses because otherwise they couldn't support themselves. Now, the reason that there could be more of these in-between or semi-religious is a term that's often used on the continent in Europe. There are other terms. The reason that they could do it is because they could do things like textiles. They could do they could find ways to support themselves that sat at this kind of juncture between the city and their houses. But the more fundamental problem about Latin vernacular, choir work, and so on, that problem is actually the same in women's houses that are professed, as distinguished from those that are in these all these kinds of other statuses, Beguines and all the rest of them, tertiaries and so on.
All right, last question here in the front.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously a very important sociological question in the 20th century, and it's actually an important 19th century question, and people like Marx began to speak to it already, being alienated from your labor and the fruits of your labor and so on. These are issues that they were conscious about. The question of whether the labor of working in the field under less than ideal conditions were better or worse for prayer than working at a desk. I mean, these are hard things to measure. I think, having grown up in Iowa, I have great empathy for the old agricultural way of life and have some sense of it, a way many academic colleagues no longer do. But it's the problem you're raising is a problem about the changes in the technology and sociology of labor broadly, which then affect as well for religious people the question of how the intersection can or cannot work, that shifts with it, right?
Can I chime in? There's a late medieval clear sense that the true sense of labor is work in the fields, and
yeah.
You find that in Piers Plowman.
Yeah, well, that's Piers Plowman.
In the 16th century, with a movement like the Diggers.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. There are now these are of course protest figures,
yeah.
Protest figures who you know. And you have to understand, I mean, there's a wonderful book by Paul Friedman on this, that say the peasant is viewed in two utterly diametric ways. One is he is held up as Christ-like for being a worker, for being the very paradigm or image of Christ, for being a worker and so on and so forth. And he's also reviled for being of the earth and earthy, and stupid and all the rest of it, and crude and stinky and so on and so forth. And both of those images simply crisscross through the whole of the Middle Ages. And sometimes one is held up and sometimes another. And Franz Reitzle points to someone like Piers Plowman where you get this he hates the mendicants. He hates he's very critical of most of the religious orders, though he is himself a cleric in London. and is often, in effect, satirizing himself on some matters. But he does idealize the peasant laborer, there's no question.
All right. Thank you all very much. Please join me again in thanking our speaker.